This is Fresh Air. 35 million Americans don't have health insurance, but lots of Americans who have it can barely afford to pay for it. President Bush and Governor Clinton have made health care reform important issues in their campaigns. Meanwhile, while they debate health policy on a national level, there's some interesting action on the state level, and we've invited Trish Riley to explain it to us. She's the executive director of the National Academy for State Health Policy in Portland, Maine. I asked her why the states are taking the initiative.
I think states are, at one level, frustrated by the slowness of federal action. Secondly, it's an extraordinarily complex issue, so it's natural that the federal government moves slowly and needs to consider that complexity. They themselves are purchasers of health care, and I think people forget this. State governments pay for their employees, their retirees, workers' compensation health care benefits. They see as a payer of health care, as a purchaser of health care, the inflated costs. They see it as a regulator, and they see it as the provider of programs like the Medicaid program, which has grown in the last several years to become the first or second largest single element of state budgets. Last year, the Medicaid program grew at 26%. And that's largely because in a time of recession and with some federal mandates and federal changes that have been allowed in that program, more and more people are eligible for the Medicaid program. So it's beginning to have an extraordinary impact on state budgets.
You've described the states as providing small laboratories of innovation. Can you give us an example of a state that you think has come up with an innovative, workable health insurance plan?
Well, there are a number, but I think most notable is Hawaii. It's always curious to me that when the debate turns to what we ought to do about health coverage in this country, we look to Canada or Germany. And in fact, we have a state that's done a fairly comprehensive job. In Hawaii, before a piece of federal legislation was enacted called ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, which disallowed this, Hawaii mandated that all employers in Hawaii must provide health insurance for their workers. It then went the next step, expanded the Medicaid program, which is the program for the poor, as far as it could to pick up individuals who were poor, but recognized that then there were still people who fell through the gaps, individuals who may not be employed, individuals who were not easily insurable. And they, in turn, created a state health insurance program, a state-funded program run through two insurance companies that picks up those individuals who aren't otherwise covered either by the Medicaid program or their mandated employer-based program.
Do you think that the Hawaii plan could be adapted by other states?
Not unless the federal government acts. At the moment, the federal government Hawaii's plan began in 1970, before 1974. In 1974, the federal government created ERISA. Again, that's the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. And what that says is states have no authority to mandate insurance coverage, basically. So it really preempts any state from doing what Hawaii has done. A state now cannot, without violating federal law, turn to their employers and say, thou shall provide health insurance. What they can do, and this is sort of an invention of the second generation, if Hawaii is the first generation of state reform, then Massachusetts and Oregon are the second generation. Those states invented the notion of pay or play. If a state cannot have authority by federal law to require an employer to pay for health insurance, it can still control state tax policy and can say, okay, employer, I can't tell you to pay for insurance, but I can tell you that if you don't, you're going to pay some kind of tax.
Oregon had proposed a plan to basically cover everyone below poverty level, but coverage for some procedures would have been eliminated under this plan. Mm-hmm. The president rejected this plan by refusing to grant a special waiver. Let me ask you to explain what the plan was and why it was rejected by the president.
Well, the Oregon health plan is certainly more complicated than the press around this so-called rationing would make it seem. What Oregon intended to do was a very comprehensive approach. The press has tended to focus on just the limits of the plan. What they intended, currently the Medicaid program nationally provides coverage, even though it is the program for poor people. That's its design, that's its structure, that's what it's intended to do. In fact, it only pays for 40% of the nation's poor. Oregon said that's wrong. If it's a public program for the poor, it must pay for 100% of all those who are poor. So what Oregon said is they're going to turn things on their head. And instead of having a very rich, broad set of services fundable through Medicaid for 40% of poor people, they were going to create a basic benefit and make it available for everyone, all poor people. Secondly, they would say to employers, you too shall make this benefit plan available for your workers. And they too enacted a pay-or-play provision that would have required, had the federal waivers gone into effect, required employers to enact the same kind of provisions, to create the same kind of basic health plan for their workers as Medicaid would have. So it was, in fact, a comprehensive approach to assure all Oregonians had health coverage. The secretary sent back the request from Oregon on the grounds that it may discriminate against persons with disabilities. It may violate the Americans with Disabilities Act. We think that creates a very serious precedent and raises some very serious concerns about health reform generally. But according to the secretary, as I understand it, he argues that when asking a community what it values in health care, there is an inherent discrimination on the part of that community to not value certain kinds of activities that a person with disabilities might. For example, the community at large may conclude that an individual with cirrhosis of the liver who is an alcoholic ought not to be treated. And indeed, in the Oregon list, that individual would not be treated, would not get certain kinds of treatments. Those who advocate that the Americans with Disabilities Act protects persons with disabilities would argue that that alcoholic is a person with disabilities, and his idea of quality of life may be fundamentally different than those of us who don't have that disability.
Do you think that the rejection of the Oregon plan is a setback for state health advances?
I think it sets a precedent that could indeed raise very serious issues of, for example, states, many states have now created bare-bones insurance plans. They've said, we understand that small employers have a difficult time paying for affordable health coverage. 25 states have enacted provisions that would allow those states to cover basic benefit plans, bare-bones insurance plans, stripped of mandated benefits. What that means is, in those states, in those 25 states that have enacted these plans, and 12 more are pending, they will provide to small employers a very basic benefit plan that doesn't include mental health services in many instances, that doesn't include non-therapeutic rehabilitation. So if you're a person with handicaps, physical handicaps, who needs some kind of rehab just to get through the day, but it's not going to make you any better, those services would not be paid for in many of the bare-bones plans. One could easily argue that if the secretary is correct in his Oregon decision, that those bare-bones programs are also violations. And that's currently a rage in the states, and you see many states enacting just such provisions. So I think what the Oregon decision does is raise more questions than it answers.
Mm-hmm. You know,
and the sad truth is that those people who really want to see a solution to bring equity of health care and access to health care to all, and equity and access to persons with disabilities, are set at each other's throats, and that's something we want very much to avoid.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Trish Riley. She's the executive director of the National Academy for State Health Policy in Portland, Maine. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about health care reform with Trish Riley, who directs the National Academy for State Health Policy. What do you think is the appropriate balance between the state and federal responsibility in the area of health insurance?
Well, I think it's certainly more than health insurance. It's we need to think not just about what kind of access, what kind of financing we have to care, but what kind of system of care is out there. And that's terribly important, because even if we somehow had a magic wand and could tomorrow create sufficient financing for health care in America, the question remains, are there enough doctors? No. Are they in the right places? No. Do we have the right kinds of facilities in the right places? No. So there's clearly a role for the states to help design the infrastructure of the healthcare system, to help work with the federal government in redesigning medical education. And I would argue for designing the system of care that makes sense for their states. West Virginia has problems with black lung disease. New Jersey has particular problems with HIV infection caused by drug abuse. Texas has some particular problems of on the border with migrant workers. Each state has a singular set of needs and capacities that needs to be considered in any kind of health reform.
Could we solve the health care crisis in this country on the state level?
Not alone. I think it requires to solve this problem, requires a partnership between the federal and state governments, between consumer groups, employers, providers. It requires that kind of sitting around a table to come to terms with what kind of system we want, how much we want to pay, what kind of choices we want to allow ourselves, and what kind of choices we want to restrict as a society. Regrettably, it seems to me that the debate at this point is largely each individual constituency, each individual political leader coming up with his or her own proposal. And what we need are fewer proposals and more effort to reach consensus. The Pepper Commission that was chaired by Senator Jay Rockefeller was one such effort, but people seem not yet willing to come to terms with the need to agree on a direction and set a course to achieve it.
You know, one of the really big problems, both for employers who are offering health care plans and for individuals who have to buy the plans on their own, is that they're so expensive. Do you see any possibility in the near future for decreasing the cost of having health insurance for the sake both of employers and of individuals?
Well, that clearly has to be a major part of any kind of reform effort, is how will we contain the costs and where and how. The Minnesota proposal, for example, which will create a broad publicly subsidized program for individuals who don't otherwise have insurance, pledges itself to reduce health care costs over 5 years by 10%. How they'll do that will be quite interesting. Vermont, through their global budget, intends to do the same. New York, with the attempt to relieve administrative costs through the creation of a single claims form, again, is another approach toward the same. We have lots of experiments and many questions, but I don't think we yet have a very clear conclusion about cost containment, nor is there a magic wand. It's all of those things. It's the elimination of administrative costs. It's the assurance that people receive care in a preventive manner so that they don't have expensive acute episodes that are otherwise avoidable. It's the, frankly, the need to reform medical malpractice and the litigious nature of our healthcare industry and the growing costs there. It's the necessity to consider what's an appropriate test, what's an appropriate technology, what's an appropriate use of resources. These are very tough, value-laden questions that this society has got to grapple with.
You direct the National Academy for State Health Policy in Portland, Maine. Do you get health insurance as part of your benefits?
No, we don't. We're just in the process of getting them, as a matter of fact, as we speak.
You don't have health benefits.
We've been affiliated with the University of Maine, and we've been getting health benefits from them, but we're now in the process of creating our own benefit as we grow.
So what are you looking for?
Well, we're actually in the same process as every small employer. We're trying to get a plan that makes sense for a workforce that's very different and very diverse. So at this point, we can't, because of the smallness of our group, we cannot get an HMO coverage, which we'd like to. Some of our workers have permanent residence out of state. So we're in the negotiating stage now, but we're leaving one insurer to pick up another one, and we fully appreciate what employers go through.
Tell me what else you're up against in trying to come up with a good plan.
Well, the issue is cost. The issue is that we have a very small group of 7 employees. Some of them get health coverage from dependents. Others have dependents who need coverage. We're trying to convert some workers from a plan that's very rich, that provides 100% dependent coverage. And, of course, the issue is affordability and quality of the health care plan. Many of these individuals are coming from large state governments and universities, which have very rich plans, and when you're a 7-person shop, it's a tough thing to negotiate for. We are, like every other small business, confronted with limited choices and expensive plans.
So you're really kind of seeing this from both sides here. You're having to deal with this as, like, the head of the group and also as somebody who needs a good policy.
That's exactly right. We see this both as advocates for states and as a small business.
Trish Riley, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.